Chapter 4. The Earliest Glimmers of Life. At 3.5 billion years old, sedimentary rocks of the Warrawoona group, Western Australia, provide one of our earliest glimpses of life and environments on the young Earth. Warrawoona rocks contain stromatolites and microscopic structures interpreted as fossil bacteria, but these interpretations remain contentious. Chemical signatures provide more convincing evidence of life's antiquity, although the type of biology they record is also uncertain. In geological investigations of Earth's earliest life, we still look through a glass darkly. James Hutton, the late 18th century father of geology, wrote in challenging prose, but he did manage one epigram familiar to every Earth scientist. "The geological record," Hutton observed, "shows no vestige of a beginning, no prospect of an end." Prospects of an end still seem remote, but over the past two decades, paleontologists have uncovered what can genuinely be regarded as vestiges of life's beginnings. On a sunny day in late July, I am off to North Pole to examine these vestiges. Heat and dust permeate the cab as our Land Rover rattles over the rutted dirt track. There are flies everywhere. This North Pole, you see, lies in northwestern Australia, its name, with characteristic Aussie humor, marking one of the hottest places on Earth, figure 4.1. Bumping along in the passenger seat, I listen idly to Frank Sinatra on the radio as I try to read the geological landscape around us. It isn't easy. Trained to discriminate among shades of gray and Arctic outcrops, my eyes fail me in the Australian bush, where everything is tinted red. Fortunately, I'm in good hands. At the wheel is Roger Buick, at the time a Harvard postdoctoral fellow and now professor of geology at the University of Washington, a brilliant iconoclast whose wiry frame and unruly mane camouflage the sophisticated scholar within. Roger has eyes of unparalleled geological keenness in these low, rubbly hills. Covered only sparsely by needle-sharp spinifex grass and scraggly acacias, the North Pole hills expose an extraordinary remnant of the early Earth, a thick succession of volcanic and sedimentary rocks called the Warrawoona Group that formed nearly 3.5 billion years ago. Folded and compressed between ovoid domes of granite, these rocks have for the most part been profoundly altered by metamorphic heat and pressure. Only at North Pole and a few other spots has some tectonic grace preserved them in a little modified state. This is the place to ask questions about the antiquity of life. Before asking such questions, however, we need to address an issue that was glossed over in our discussion of Spitsbergen rocks, proof of age. How do we know that the North Pole rocks formed more than 3 billion years ago? Geologic time can be measured in two ways. Any event discernible in the rock record can be used to divide Earth history into three intervals: the time preceding the event, the time of the event itself, and all subsequent time. By mapping the distribution and spatial relationships of rocks seen locally, a series of events can be placed in order of occurrence to form a relative time scale. In principle, though not always in practice, the rules are straightforward. Sediments, ash spewed from volcanoes, and lava flows settle by gravity onto the land surface or seafloor. For this reason, any such layered rock will be younger than the beds it covers. Volcanic rocks that intrude into other units must be younger than the rocks they pierce. And events that alter rock accumulations, folding, faulting, erosion, and metamorphism, obviously must post-date deposition. Knowing these simple relationships, we can work out the relative timing of events evident in a road cut, quarry, or mountainside. For example, in the geological cross-section cartooned in Figure 4.2, the oldest identifiable event is the deposition of bed A, followed sequentially by the formation of beds B through F. Later, these beds were folded and, after that, intruded by granite G. Then, after erosion planed off these older units, beds H through J were laid down. The fault on the right-hand side of the figure cuts all older sedimentary units and, therefore, must have occurred late. The youngest event we can infer from the cross-section is the erosion that sculpted the current land surface. Extension of such a local history to the global scale requires a means of establishing the time relationships of rock units found in different regions, say in the Rockies and the Appalachians, or in North America and Australia. For rocks deposited since the Cambrian explosion, fossils provide our best guide to stratigraphic correlation. Indeed, the eras, periods, and finer subdivisions of the geologic timescale reflect more than anything else the changing composition of life through time. Sedimentary and volcanic rocks may also preserve distinctive features of chemistry or magnetism that complement, or in some cases, substitute for correlations based on fossils. Fossils can reveal that two rock units are the same age, but they cannot tell us what that age is. For that, we need a natural chronometer capable of recording quantitatively the passage of time. Radioactive isotopes bound into rock-forming minerals provide geology's clocks. Radioisotopes are inherently unstable atoms that decay spontaneously to stable daughter elements at rates that can be measured accurately in the laboratory. This being the case, if we can determine how much of a radioactive parent element has disappeared from a mineral through time, or how much stable daughter has accumulated, we can calculate the age of the mineral itself. Interestingly, what remains constant in radioactive decay is the proportion of radioisotopes that decay in a set interval, not the number of atoms. Thus, as the abundance of a radioactive isotope in a mineral decreases through time, the absolute rate at which the isotope decays also declines. The pace at which a radioactive isotope decays is called its half-life, the time it takes for half of the radioisotope in a mineral to decay to another element. Classically educated listeners will be reminded of Zeno's paradox, the ancient Greek puzzler in which Achilles chases a hare. Being a hero, Achilles runs faster than his prey, halving the distance between hunter and hunted each minute. When will Achilles catch the hare? The answer, of course, is never, because if the hare is moving at a constant speed, Achilles must continually be slowing down. Starting at a 200-yard disadvantage, he may race 200 yards in the first minute to the hare's 100, but in minute 2 he'll cover only 150 yards, and by minute 4 he'll make a mere 112.5 yards. Note that if we know how far Achilles has run and how his speed varies with distance from the hare, we can figure out how long he's been pursuing his frustrating chase. This, in essence, is how radiometric dating works. The best-known radiometric dating system is provided by carbon-14, a rare isotope of carbon produced naturally by cosmic rays and anthropogenically by nuclear bombs. It decays to nitrogen, nitrogen-14, with a half-life of 5,730 years. Because carbon-14 is so uncommon, it makes up fewer than 1 in every 1,000 carbon atoms, and its half-life so short, radiocarbon dating is limited to the past 100,000 years or so. In older materials, there simply isn't enough carbon-14 left to measure accurately. In consequence, carbon-14 provides a great tool for Egyptologists or paleontologists interested in woolly mammoths, but it cannot help unravel Earth's deep history. To date the Warrawoona succession, we need a more stately clock, a radioisotope whose half-life is measured in many millions or even billions of years. Potassium-40 was recognized early on as a promising candidate for geochronology. This unstable isotope breaks down to form either calcium, calcium-40, which unfortunately can't be differentiated from calcium ions already in the mineral, or argon, argon-40, which can. The half-life of potassium-40 is 1.25 billion years. Further, potassium is abundant and widely distributed in rock-forming minerals. It occurs in the feldspars that tint granites pink, in the microscopic minerals of volcanic ash and in clays that form during weathering. Despite these advantages, the potassium-argon chronometer is not much used by geologists interested in the early Earth. If potassium-40 behaves like a clock, tectonic and metamorphic processes act like toddlers eager to play with the dial. Geologic events that take place long after mineral formation can drive argon from minerals, resetting the clock and destroying the chemical memory of elapsed time. An inert gas, argon is held only loosely within the chemical lattices of minerals. What we really need to date old rocks is a system that acts like the black boxes in airplanes, an isotope not easily lost from a mineral not readily altered. Zircons, uranium-bearing minerals found in granites and related volcanic rocks, are the flight recorders of Precambrian geology. In fact, the uranium bound into zircon crystals at their time of formation provides two reliable chronometers. Uranium-238 decays to lead-206 with a half-life of about 4.5 billion years, the age of the Earth, while the rarer isotope uranium-235 breaks down to lead-207 with a half-life a bit longer than 700 million years. This provides a valuable cross-check of measured ages. If the two clocks don't give the same age, the zircon has been altered. If zircons have a problem, it is that they are too tough. Unlike most other minerals, zircons can go through the entire rock cycle, from crystallization in an igneous rock to metamorphism and subsequent erosion to form a sediment grain, without loss of chemical integrity. Indeed, magma ascending through the Earth's crust can pluck zircons from surrounding rocks, incorporating older minerals, and therefore clocks, into younger rocks. What's more, zircons can grow during each passage through the Earth's interior. Archean zircons may display a half dozen layers around a central core, each the accreted product of a specific geological event. William Compston of the Australian National University developed an ingenious instrument for plumbing the radiometric complexities of ancient zircons. Called the Sensitive High-Resolution Ion Microprobe, SHRIMP for short, years ago a fire in Compston's lab prompted the predictable flurry of throw a little shrimp on the Barbie jokes. This instrument uses fine ion beams to sample the individual growth layers of zircons so that geochemists can date each one independently. The shrimp revolutionized Archean geology, allowing geologists to unravel the complex time relationships of sedimentary, volcanic, and tectonic events on the early Earth. Now we can understand why the basal Cambrian rocks along the Cotuican River are said to be about 543 million years old. Locally, sedimentary rocks bearing the earliest Cambrian fossils are interbedded with a volcanic unit that contains zircons. Uranium-lead chronology shows that the zircons crystallized 543 million plus or minus 1 million years ago. The plus or minus 1 is an estimate of the error associated with the measured age. It is a statistical statement which indicates that the true age of crystallization has a 95% chance of falling within the interval 542 to 544 million years. Good geologists pay careful attention to those error bars. There are no well-dated rocks in the Spitsbergen succession, but fossils and chemical features of the Academicobrine group permit at least broad correlation with better-dated rocks found elsewhere. All of which brings us back to the age of the Warrawoona group. SHRIMP analyses of zircons in volcanic rocks near the top and base of the group yield ages of 3,458 million plus or minus 2 million and 3,471 million plus or minus 5 million years, respectively. Knowing these ages so precisely is a triumph of Earth science that imparts special importance to studies of Warrawoona life and environments. In the late Precambrian rocks of Spitsbergen, biological signatures can be found almost everywhere, in microfossils, in stromatolites that catch the eye wherever we look, in biomarker molecules preserved in sedimentary organic matter, and in the isotopic abundances of carbon and sulfur in rocks throughout the succession. What does the paleobiological exploration of Warrawoona rocks reveal? The sedimentary volcanic succession at North Pole is, in fact, mostly volcanic and only a little sedimentary. Not a good omen for the paleontologist. More than 95% of the unit consists of lavas poured out on land or in shallow water, along with ash layers and coarser beds made of fragmented volcanic rocks. 3.5 billion years ago, Warrawoona might have looked something like the volcanic necklace of the Indonesian archipelago. In detail, however, Archean geography resists characterization by simple analogy to modern features. Sediments, mostly preserved as dark cherts, accumulated in coastal basins nestled among the volcanoes. By now we know that chert lifts the paleontological heart, but the silica-rich rocks of North Pole formed in a manner quite different from those in Spitsbergen. These older cherts precipitated from volcanically heated fluids that percolated through Warrawoona sediments, replacing original minerals soon after deposition. Unfortunately for the paleontological heart and mind, chert formed this way is as likely to destroy biological signatures as preserve them. Further complicating the issue, at least some of the cherts occur as veins that fill cracks in the sedimentary and volcanic pile. They appear to be part of a hydrothermal plumbing system, much like the network of underground conduits that feed present-day hot springs in Yellowstone Park. Unraveling the depositional history of these rocks requires that one carefully map the distributions of constituent rock types and then use outcrop and laboratory observations to peer through the silica veil. Roger Buick did just that as a doctoral student at the University of Western Australia. Along with his Australian colleagues, Roger demonstrated that most Warrawoona sediments originated as muds, sands, and cobbles eroded from surrounding volcanoes and deposited in a flanking basin. From time to time, sandbars or other barriers blocked the basin's mouth, restricting the flow of water into coastal lagoons. Evaporation increased the concentration of dissolved calcium and carbonate ions in these waters, leading to the production of calcium carbonate as whitings, millions of tiny crystals that formed in the water column, turning the lagoon milky white before they settled onto the seafloor as lime mud. Rosettes of gypsum crystals decorate many beds, deposited as evaporation proceeded still further. Actually, the gypsum in these rocks is long gone. Its former presence is recorded by silica ghosts that preserve gypsum's distinctive crystal form, figure 4.3a. Perhaps the most unusual rocks in the North Pole region are beds of barium sulfate, or barite, fans and more continuous layers of slender prisms that grew like so much rock candy on the seafloor. Barite is uncommon in younger sedimentary successions, but Wouter Nijman and his colleagues at Utrecht University in the Netherlands believe that the large mounds of barite in the Warrawoona group formed where hot hydrothermal fluids erupted onto the seafloor. From a human perspective, these eruptions seem alien and inhospitable, but to the heat-loving microorganisms found on early branches of the Tree of Life, they would have furnished a hot microbial Eden. In the field, we can see wavy laminations in sedimentary rocks, much like the microbially laminated carbonates observed in Spitsbergen. In a few places, these laminations are bowed upward to form domes or cones, the geometric hallmarks of stromatolites, figure 4.3b. Warrawoona stromatolites were first reported in 1980 by Stanford University's Don Lowe, and independently by Australia's Malcolm Walter, John Dunlop, and of course Roger Buick. The analogy with present-day stromatolite growth, noted in the preceding chapter, was pushed to the limit. In some of the oldest sedimentary rocks on Earth, these geologists discerned a familiar signature of biology. Or did they? Early on, Roger Buick and his colleagues urged caution. The words possible and probable pervade a thoughtful essay published in 1983. It isn't, they wrote, that the Warrawoona structures can't have been built by bacteria, but rather that the actual evidence for biological accretion is iffy. And in rocks this old, with so little independent evidence of biology, the interpretational stakes are high. We want to know whether or not life existed 3.5 billion years ago, and maybe is not a satisfying conclusion. In 1990, Don Lowe retreated further. He explicitly reinterpreted Warrawoona stromatolites in terms of chemical processes that deposited layers of minerals on the seafloor and physical processes that deformed these layers into upturned folds, like carpets after a slip. In this view, the hand of life is nowhere to be seen. Why this loss of confidence in a biological interpretation? Simply put, microbial mat processes can give rise to laminated structures, but they are not the only processes that can do so. Similar features can form without microbial mats if ambient waters are highly charged with dissolved minerals. For example, in Yellowstone Park, where silica-saturated waters spill episodically from thermal springs to form laminated structures that resemble stromatolites built by microorganisms. We didn't worry much about this in Spitsbergen, because 600 to 800 million years ago, the oceans weren't sufficiently laden with calcium and carbonate, or silica, to drive this type of deposition. On the early Earth, however, ocean chemistry was different. John Grotzinger, an MIT geologist we'll meet again, has shown that Archean oceans were charged with calcium and carbonate ions, so much so that the carbonate minerals calcite and aragonite commonly formed by direct precipitation on the seafloor. These deposits include giant crystal fans whose precipitated origins are obvious, but they also encompass flat laminated beds, domes, and small columns arrayed in parallel rows. This being the case, it becomes important to examine the microscopic features of Warrawoona stromatolites to see whether mat-building fossils have been preserved. They have not, making it difficult to know to what extent organisms participated in the formation of these structures. At present, the interpretation of Warrawoona stromatolites remains unresolved. We can accept them as biological only if we can rule out alternative physical explanations. Hans Hoffmann and Kath Gray, two experienced stromatolite hands, recently discovered new Warrawoona structures that they hope will decide the case in favor of biology. The buildups, formed layer after layer by the precipitation of thin crystalline veneers, are conical, a shape rarely generated on the seafloor in the absence of microorganisms. But if the Warrawoona cones reflect life's guiding hand, what kind of biology was at work? On the modern Earth, cyanobacteria are the best-known mat-builders, and so there is a tendency to associate all ancient stromatolites with cyanobacterial mats. Other bacteria can form mats, however, and there is no a priori reason to assume that cyanobacteria existed 3.5 billion years ago. In our quest to find biological signatures in the ancient beds of Warrawoona, stromatolites provide only a suggestive scrawl, a tantalizing but ambiguous hint that life began in our planet's infancy. Spitsbergen cherts contain microfossils that are unmistakably cyanobacterial, increasing our confidence that these blue-green bacteria built contemporaneous stromatolites. Are the black cherts of Warrawoona similarly informative? For more than a decade, most people thought so, but recent reinvestigations have sown considerable doubt about Warrawoona micropaleontology. In a preliminary draft of this chapter, I recounted the 1987 discovery of Warrawoona fossils in cherts from a knobby outcrop along the dry bed of Chinaman's Creek near North Pole. In these rocks, UCLA's Bill Schopf and Bonnie Packer found tiny filaments 1 to 20 microns in diameter and up to a few hundred microns long, figure 4.4. The structures are rare and poorly preserved. The distorting effects of crystal growth are clear in published photos. Nonetheless, the photos, or at least the interpretive drawings that accompany them, look like simple cyanobacterial filaments. Equally, however, they resemble other types of bacteria, limiting taxonomic or metabolic interpretation. In Spitsbergen, knowing where a microbe grew helped us to understand how it made its living. Geology colors our thoughts about Warrawoona biology as well, but in a surprising way. Careful mapping by Australian stratigrapher Martin van Kronendonk shows that the cherty rocks at Chinaman's Creek formed beneath the Warrawoona seafloor, not on it. These cherts originated in hydrothermal veins, as outlined earlier in this chapter, figure 4.5. Conceivably, cyanobacteria could have found their way into these cracks along with other sedimentary particles, but the environmental setting revealed by geology likely favored chemosynthetic growth over photosynthesis. From here, the problems of interpretation mount. Despite reservations about the specific interpretation of Warrawoona microstructures, I had no cause to doubt their biological origins as I drafted my chapter. After all, poorly preserved fossils with shapes obscured by mineral growth occur throughout the geological record. Why should the old cherts of Warrawoona be any different? Before committing my opinions to print, however, I wanted to see the Warrawoona material for myself. Surprisingly, the place to view purported Warrawoona fossils is not Sydney or Perth or even Los Angeles. It is London, in the collections of the Natural History Museum. In September 2000, I had to cross the ocean for a scientific meeting in Oxford, and so made arrangements to spend a quiet day at the museum before returning home. I also planned a not-so-quiet day in Oxford, visiting Martin Brazier, a well-known paleontologist and connoisseur of local pubs. Fortunately, I told Martin of my hope to study the Warrawoona rocks, and he in turn told me that the key samples were out on loan, to Oxford. In Martin's lab, in a quaint Edwardian building off Parks Road, we spent a revealing day examining thin sections of Warrawoona chert. In Spitsbergen cherts, microfossils are abundant. They have shapes similar to those of living microorganisms, but different from shapes made by purely physical and chemical processes. Most retain at least some of their original organic matter, and some even occur in environmental settings much like those of close living counterparts. No comparable claims can be made about the Warrawoona microstructures. Observed through the microscope in Martin's lab, the tiny filaments in Warrawoona rocks looked like minerals. As a boy, I often spent idle summer afternoons gazing at clouds. Most were billowy masses, beautiful but shapeless. Every now and again, however, an unmistakable face appeared in the sky, or a castle, or a lion. For a moment, the shapes took striking form, but even as a youngster, I was pretty sure that they were, in the end, just clouds. Are the Warrawoona microstructures just clouds as well? That question is difficult to answer based on a few pictures cut and cropped for publication. It requires context, the framework provided by the overall rock fabric seen in thin sections of Warrawoona chert. It was the rest of the clouds that revealed my air castles as watery illusions, and it is the overall fabric of Warrawoona cherts that casts doubt on those rare features that look biological. Martin and his colleagues painstakingly documented how volcanic and hydrothermal processes shaped the cherts from Chinaman's Creek. They believe that physical processes can account for all microscopic features of the cherts, including those singled out as fossils. If this interpretation is correct, the Warrawoona microstructures cannot be cellular filaments, only stacked crystals that mimic but do not preserve a record of biology. Are paleontology's crown jewels, so old and rare, made of paste? In fairness, Bill Schopf, disputes this reading. In a rebuttal to the claim by Brazier and colleagues, Bill and University of Alabama chemist Tom Dowiak showed that the disputed Warrawoona structures contain organic matter at their margins. This, of course, is consistent with the view that they are microfossils, but it doesn't end the debate. Archean cherts commonly contain the ghosts of early formed minerals whose distinctive shapes are preserved by a veneer of organic matter. My own guess is that most Warrawoona structures are mineral chains draped by an organic film that may itself have a biological origin. Continuing study may yet confirm the presence of fossils in these rocks. The debate is far from over. But I doubt that any such remains will teach us much about early ecosystems. Warrawoona microstructures, like Warrawoona stromatolites, can only suggest that something interesting and important lies just beyond our grasp. Biomarker molecules are not retained in rocks from North Pole, but isotopic signatures are. The carbon and sulfur isotopes of Warrawoona rocks provide our best indication of life's deep history. As in Spitsbergen, and nearly everywhere else that sedimentary rocks were deposited in Precambrian times, carbon-13 to carbon-12 ratios in Warrawoona carbonates and organic matter differ by about 30 parts per thousand. This difference is most easily explained by photosynthesis, but given our experience with stromatolites and microfossils, we should ask once more whether physical processes can mimic the effects of biology. Some chemical reactions do form organic molecules depleted in carbon-13. Only under carefully controlled experimental conditions, however, does non-biological fractionation approach the levels recorded in Warrawoona rocks. For this reason, the consistently large fractionation measured in North Pole samples suggests the presence of an early biosphere. Carbon isotopes in organic matter from the chert veins that cut through Warrawoona sediments and lavas could record chemosynthetic bacteria that lived in hydrothermal waters. But the widespread distribution of organic matter in sedimentary rocks deposited on the seafloor supports the hypothesis that photosynthesis fueled microbial life in the Warrawoona Ocean. Whether primary producers were mostly cyanobacteria or other types of photosynthetic bacteria with a similar isotopic signature remains uncertain. Sulfur isotopes in sedimentary pyrite and barite likewise suggest that sulfate-reducing bacteria lived in the Warrawoona Lagoon, although this too has been questioned by geologists grown skeptical about early Archean biosignatures. At present, that's about all we can say. The heat-scorched hills of North Pole suggest that life existed 3.5 billion years ago, and that by itself is remarkable. Warrawoona communities may have included photosynthetic microorganisms and other microbes with metabolisms still seen today. But many uncertainties persist. Warrawoona paleobiology remains a shadow play whose apparently familiar themes may be deceptive. Northwestern Australia is one of two places in the world that contain well-preserved sedimentary rocks as old as 3.5 billion years. The other is the rugged Barberton Mountain land near Kruger Park in South Africa. The two areas are similar, so much so that some geologists believe that they form parts of a single ancient terrain severed by plate tectonic movements long before the Archean. Their paleontological inventories bear comparison as well. Both include stromatolites of uncertain origin, along with organic matter whose carbon isotopic composition and sedimentary distribution suggest some type of photosynthesis. Both have been heated to temperatures that destroy biomarker molecules. And, like those of Warrawoona, Barberton cherts contain spherical and filamentous microstructures reminiscent of fossils. As a graduate student, I had a go at Archean paleontology, traveling to Africa as Elzo Barghorn's field assistant. Having grown up on Tarzan books, I was excited as the plane touched down in Johannesburg late at night. I couldn't wait to catch my first glimpse of Africa the next morning, and was only a little disappointed that the view from my hotel window looked a lot like Chicago. Within hours, we were on the road, and as the cityscape receded in the rearview mirror, the great South African veldt opened before us. Culturally, ecologically, and geologically, the Barberton Mountain land was new to me. In each clump of thorn trees I sensed menace, and in each chert I espied fame. Neither fame nor menace materialized, but the cherts did turn out to contain microstructures that are probably, if not unambiguously, biological. In one particular sample, marked by centimeter-scale stromatolite-like precipitates, I discovered a large population of spherical microstructures 2 to 4 microns in diameter, the size and shape of small cyanobacteria, figure 4.6a. The structures occur in individual laminae. Moreover, they are made of organic matter, and some preserve both an outer wall and a raisin-like interior body, also organic. The microstructures are compressed along the bedding surface, much like younger microfossils. Indeed, this slight flattening tells us that the structures formed before enclosing sediments were compacted by burial. The distribution of sizes in the population matches that of modern cyanobacteria, and the structures also show evidence of binary division, again, much like living blue-greens. So, are these fossil cyanobacteria? Not necessarily. Many different bacteria are small and spherical. More sobering, non-biological processes can, in principle, produce similar structures, although it isn't obvious that such processes were at work in the Barberton Seaway. The Barberton spheres, thus, fall only a few steps ahead of Warrawoona filaments. They could be fossil cyanobacteria or some other type of microorganism. They could record a primordial microbe that is long extinct. Or they could be carbonaceous spheres formed by physical processes on the Barberton seafloor. We simply don't know. More recently, Maud Walsh of Louisiana State University has made a careful study of the organic matter in Barberton cherts, finding bedding textures most easily explained as mats and thin filaments that may be microfossils. What kind of planet can we piece together from these fragments? Geologically, it appears to have been a world of familiar processes, but not so familiar patterns. Continents began to form at least 4.2 billion years ago, and chemical details of volcanic rocks from Barberton, Warrawoona, and other old terrains suggest that a large volume of continental crust had formed by the time they were deposited. Little of these early continents remains, however, implying that on the early Earth, continents were recycled back into the mantle more easily than they are today. 3.5 billion years ago, plate tectonics had already begun to pattern our planetary surface, but Earth's upper mantle appears to have been hotter, the basaltic crust beneath the oceans thicker, and, perhaps, the continents smaller and less stable. Then, as now, continental crust probably formed at plate margins, where descending slabs of oceanic crust cause overlying rocks to melt. On the other hand, early continent formation may have received a significant boost from a source that is no longer important. Partial melting of basalts buried beneath thick piles of lava spilled onto the seafloor. The rock record that survives from the early Earth is not simply the fragment of a geologically modern planet buffeted by time. Something about the character and mix of processes that form and destroy continents was different, and though many insightful scientists have hazarded opinions, we don't fully understand what it was. We have a bit more confidence that when the Warrawoona Seaway formed, Earth was a biological planet. Moreover, the evidence of carbon isotopes suggests that the great ecological liberation of photosynthesis may already have begun. Whether or not contemporary microorganisms included the oxygen-producing cyanobacteria is uncertain, But the presence of any type of photosynthetic organism in the Warrawoona Ocean speaks volumes, because it allows us to place a calibration point on the tree of life introduced in Chapter 2. In the new view of microbial evolution symbolized by the tree, photosynthetic organisms are relative latecomers that diversified long after the origin of life and the divergence of biology's principal domains. If Warrawoona organic matter was made by photosynthesis, then a great deal of evolution must already have taken place. Microorganisms appear to have cycled carbon, sulfur, and nitrogen through early Archean ecosystems, just as they do today. There is no record of eukaryotes or Archaeans in these oldest rocks, but then there aren't many fossils, period, and it would be hazardous to interpret the absence of evidence as evidence for absence. The branching pattern of the Tree of Life tells us that if photosynthetic bacteria lived in the Warrawoona Sea, then at least some archaea were almost certainly present. We have one more constraint on early Archean biology. Consistent with our environmental reading of the tree, geological observations indicate that 3.5 billion years ago, Earth's atmosphere contained nitrogen, carbon dioxide, and water vapor, but little free oxygen. Most inferences about ancient environments are gleaned from subtle geochemical clues, but the sedimentary signature of oxygen limitation is flamboyant. Bright red bands of cherty rock rich in the iron oxide mineral hematite, Fe2O3, aptly named Banded Iron Formation, BIF for short, these rocks do not form in the present-day ocean. In fact, with one important exception, they haven't accumulated for the past 1.85 billion years. But for the first half of Earth history, BIFs were a standard component of marine sediments. The reason that BIFs do not form today is that iron entering the oceans immediately encounters oxygen and precipitates as iron oxide. As a result, iron concentrations in modern seawater are extremely low. The BIF in Archean sedimentary successions may have formed by the reaction of iron with oxygen, or the iron may have been oxidized by photosynthetic bacteria or UV radiation that penetrated to the sea surface in the absence of an effective ozone shield. However they were precipitated, the BIFs tell us that on the early Earth, iron didn't get stripped away as it entered the sea. Instead, iron was readily transported in solution throughout the deep ocean. This could only happen if deep waters were free of oxygen, forcing us to conclude that the Archean atmosphere and the sea surface in contact with that atmosphere had much less oxygen than today. Just how much oxygen was present is contentious, but it couldn't have been more than about 1% of present-day levels, and may have been much less. Under these conditions, aerobic respiration and chemosynthetic metabolisms that depend on molecular oxygen may have been limited or absent, depending on just how much oxygen was available. Together, then, geology and microbiology suggest that early Archean oceans differed from those of younger intervals, containing much less oxygen, but more iron. The early ocean may have been warmer than today's, but geology provides us with few real constraints on Archean climate. All we can say is that if photosynthesis was present, surface waters could have been no warmer than 74 degrees Celsius, the maximum temperature tolerated by photosynthetic organisms. The Tree of Life suggests that the earliest bacteria and archaea lived at higher temperatures, but this need not be interpreted to mean that the entire ocean was hot. Early heat-loving microbes might well have lived in hydrothermal environments, like those inhabited by their descendants today. How can we amplify the weak biological signal in early Archean rocks? Two strategies come readily to mind. One concerns how we look for evidence, and the other, where we search. As the saga of Warrawoona illustrates, the paleontological search strategy that has worked so well in younger rocks, collect black chert and lots of it, has not been notably successful in early Archean rocks. Malcolm Walter, a leading Australian paleontologist, has advocated a different kind of search, one that focuses on the very hydrothermal processes that ravaged the contents of preserved cherts. As noted earlier, hydrothermal systems are home to some of the earliest branching organisms on the tree of life. Moreover, hydrothermal springs commonly deposit carbonate and silica minerals that might preserve records of early biology. Chimneys of pyrite and other minerals also form at some hydrothermal vents in the ocean. Comparable deposits occur in early Archean terrains, but until recently they have not received much attention from paleontologists. This situation is changing, however, and in early 2000, Australian geologist Birger Rasmussen reported convincingly biological, if metabolically uninformative, filaments from hydrothermal mineral deposits that, at 3.2 billion years, are not much younger than Warrawoona, figure 4.6b. I anticipate that as our search strategy widens, our understanding of early biology will grow proportionately. The second obvious research path is to discover older rocks. Because of our planet's restless surface, metamorphism, uplift, and erosion continually alter and destroy the rock record. Successively older periods of time are represented by ever smaller volumes of rock. This being the case, it is no simple task to find little altered sedimentary rocks older than the Warrawoona and Barberton successions. Yet, Roger Buick has done just that. In a remote area of northwestern Australia, he discovered a succession of sedimentary and volcanic rocks that lies beneath the Warrawoona group. Christened the Kuntaruna Succession, these beds contain volcanic rocks dated at 3,515 million plus or minus 3 million years, not dramatically older than the Warrawoona rocks that cover them, but nonetheless a step deeper into Earth history. Kuntaruna rocks include sedimentary beds deposited in deep water environments along with basaltic lavas, but to date they have not yielded fossils. Steve Moisish and his colleagues took a bigger step backward to circa 3.8 billion-year-old rocks on Achillea Island off the coast of southwestern Greenland. These rocks have been severely altered by metamorphism, making it difficult to read their geologic history. Moisish and colleagues interpret the rocks as sediments laid down on an ancient seafloor. Within the rocks, they found tiny grains of mineral phosphate, and within these mineral grains, still tinier inclusions of reduced carbon, graphite. Using an ion microprobe, Moisish measured the isotopic composition of the carbon and found that it is strongly depleted in carbon-13, consistent with formation by biological processes. But nothing is ever simple in Archean geology. After careful re-examination of the Achillea rocks, a team led by phosphate expert Gus Arrhenius, one of the and colleagues in Moisish's original group, concluded that the phosphate grains formed relatively late in the history of these rocks, during alteration by hot metamorphic fluids. Moreover, Arrhenius and colleagues believe that the graphite in these grains formed at the same time, by chemical reaction of metamorphic fluids with iron carbonate in the rock. Independent research by geologists Christopher Fedo and Martin Whitehouse supports a metamorphic origin for key features of the Achillea rocks. Indeed, Fedo and Whitehouse believe that the rocks originated as igneous bodies deep within the Earth's interior. Here's one more debate still to be resolved. But if the revised interpretation is correct, the carbon in Achillea rocks can tell us nothing about life. In fact, Arrhenius's conclusions undermine more than that. Recall that those graphite crystals in Achillea phosphate grains have carbon isotope ratios much like organic matter produced by photosynthesis. If physical processes can fractionate carbon isotopes by up to 50 parts per thousand, then our faith in carbon isotope composition as a biosignature is shaken. Faith shaken, but also perhaps faith restored. Elsewhere in southwestern Greenland, Minik Rosing of the Geological Museum in Copenhagen, Denmark, has found a succession of metamorphosed shales some 160 feet thick. The rocks are more than 3.7 billion years old, are assuredly sedimentary, and contain abundant particles of graphite distributed much like the organic matter in younger shales. And once again, carbon isotopes suggest biological activity. In this case, however, Rosing argues convincingly that his graphites formed by the heating of organic matter, not the alteration of older minerals. Biology provides the simplest explanation for the chemistry in Rosing's rocks, but a second line of evidence would be reassuring. At present, our knowledge of Archean life and environments is both frustrating and exhilarating. Frustrating because we are certain of so little, but exhilarating because we know anything at all. It is stimulating as well, because the companion of ignorance is opportunity. Some of the biggest questions focus on what came before Warrawoona, or Barberton, or even Aquileia. If the oldest sedimentary rocks we can identify provide hints of complex microorganisms, what kind of cells lived still earlier? Indeed, how did biology arise in the first place?